Hey, this is Todd Stashwick, and you are listening to Improv Nerd with Jimmy Corain.
Everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, The Art of Slow Comedy, where we teach you, before you can be funny, you need to be real. And you know what happens? You're even funnier. I've got an advanced ensemble class, two sections, starting in October, the end of October. I limit it to 10 people, and then there's a long-form performance at the end at stage 773. And we really work on long form in terms of energy and variety and editing and walk-ons and all that stuff. So if you're interested, you can go to my website. That's jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com for information on the art of slow comedy. Also, we're brought to you by the good people at the Hotel Lincoln. So the next time you find yourself here in the city of Chicago and you're looking for a cool boutique hotel that's close to everything, right around the corner from Second City, it's also improviser-friendly and pet-friendly as well. And I'm not making that up. Check out the official hotel of Improv Nerd, Hotel Lincoln. This is our fourth and final episode that we taped down in Austin for the Out of Bounds Comedy Festival. So I'm feeling a little sad because I had such a great time there. And we could not end with a better show. Our guest today, you know him from every show imaginable. Just go IMDb him. But he's been on stuff like Curb Your Enthusiasm, Law & Order, CSI, Weeds. He's going to be featured in Gotham, the new series that's coming up today. He's got an extensive theater and improv background. I first knew him down in Chicago here at the Second City. I'm talking about no other than the super talented and great guy, Todd Stashwick. And we talked to Todd about how he went from theater into improv comedy and who his influences were. We also talked about while he was in Chicago, he got mugged and how that changed his life. And also his approach to improv, which is unique. It's a very unique approach that of all the guests, and we've had over 100 episodes, this is the first guest that really broke down how he starts an improv scene and how he starts physically. So you're really going to enjoy that. But before we get to that, I just want to say, you know, if you listen to this podcast, you know I'm filled with shame. I'm 80% shame and about 20% water. And I'm always looking for it. I'm like a heroin addict who never can find enough shame and will find it in the most unusual places. The other day, I walked to our local grocery store here. It's a grocery store chain. I don't know why I'm in such a rush on this, but I'll slow down for you. We have a grocery store chain here called Jewel Osco, and they've been around for 150 years. Actually, they're getting really proud about it because there was another chain that closed. It was a long-standing chain called Dominick's, and they closed. So Jewel is now claiming that they're like the oldest grocery store in Chicago. I think Abraham Lincoln worked in the deli. That's how far back they go. So I went there because I love grocery shopping. It's my way of relaxing. And when I got there and I was checking out with my groceries, there was a gift card. And it was on that little platform where you used to write a check, but now they have that keypad that you use to swipe your cards, your credit or your debit card. And I'm like, oh, should I take it? Should I not take it? Is this stealing? Or is this the universe saying, hey, here's some more abundance? And I wasn't going to say anything to the checker, the cashier, because I don't trust anybody, especially in retail. I figured if I give it to her, she has no obligation to turn it over to anybody. So I checked out and I took the card. And instead of having her check the value, because I had to know if there was value on the card, I went behind her back, literally and figuratively, because there was another cashier next to her, and I asked that cashier to check if there was any value, to swipe it on her cash register to see if there was any value. So I did that, and of course, cashier number one, the one I checked out with, was like all over me. She was like, "That isn't his card. He found it right here." And I was just, I felt all this shame in my body. I'm like, what am I doing? I'm a criminal, because I do come from a criminal background. My dad was a white-collar criminal, and all that stuff comes back to me. And so the cashier number two checked it, and there was no value to it. And I just was, you know, staying cool. So I said, okay, let's just throw it out. And the cashier number one was like, it wasn't his card anyways, blah, blah, blah. And I'm leaving the store thinking, oh, my God, I am the worst person ever. I can never go back to this Juul again. What am I going to do? This is where I get my peace and serenity. This is my sanctuary. What have I done? So I haven't gone back to the Juul yet, but I think I'm over it, and I think I'm ready to go back. Enough about me. Let's move on to this episode. You're going to love this episode. Todd Stashwick, such an accomplished actor, such an accomplished improviser. Here it is, the Todd Stashwick episode.
Oh, yeah, Jimmy's a nerd. Oh, yeah, Jimmy's a nerd. Oh, yeah.
Sit over here.
Yeah, sit here.
Thank you so much for doing this show.
Thank
I've wanted to do
me.
This show with you for a long time.
Okay.
Because you are a guy.
Yes.
Okay. That books a lot of stuff. And we were talking backstage. Mm-hmm. I said, you've had a great career.
I can't complain.
Okay. You say you can't complain.
I can't complain.
But then you were kind of comparing yourself to Tina and Amy.
What you had opened the conversation with sort of saying you've done better than like anybody of our generation, and I went and he and I were in Chicago like in that golden 90 to 95 was my time in Chicago,
right.
And those that came out of that are McKay and Amy Poehler and Tina Fey and Colbert and Carell, and so when I go, well, those guys kind of move the needle of entertainment. I can't complain.
Okay, are you a guy who compares yourself to other people? I do it all the time, and I do it to make myself feel worse. Do you compare yourself to other people's careers?
You can't help but when you sort of watch the starter pistol kind of go off at the same time, and then there's moments where you're like, I gotta. Oh shit, they're way ahead of me. I'm a human being, and you sort of set out with your map of what's going to happen. Then you go, oh well, there's logs blocking that, and so I got to go this way. And then you go, okay, so the path changes, and then you see what seems like. And Carell was one of those guys that we thought was going to just step right off main stage into superstardom.
Right.
But it took him 15 years to chip away at the block before he was a household name. So when you get to LA, you find the road is much, much more winding, and often it's going to present stuff that you didn't expect, and there's that sort of impact.
And when you got to LA, you struggled too, right?
No.
You didn't struggle in LA?
You know what? I will be honest. Struggle probably came after I got to LA. Like, I was very fortunate because I had kind of come from New York I had done a national television commercial that oddly only ran in Los Angeles, only during the Today Show, during pilot season. And so I came out and it was just me trying to set up a tent, just doing shtick. And so my agents, back when people would watch the Today Show, my agents could just go, he's the Jeep guy. And they go, oh, he's hilarious, bring him in. So I was fortunate enough that I kind of hit the ground running when I first got to LA.
Mm-hmm.
And then in about 2 years in is when, and I was just kind of booking consistently and doing pilots. And then I sort of, I had to turn into the skid. That's when things sort of broke a little bit. And I had to, went, oh, it's not just like, show after show after show, you know, and so I kind of had a head of steam at first when I first got to LA, and then things sort of leveled out, and it got, I had to go to the teacher and fix it and stuff like that.
So let's go back to how you started in Chicago.
Okay.
When I knew you.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into improv?
Well, I think the seeds were always planted that I was going to...
You were a theater guy.
I'm sitting here talking to you,
right.
And I just realized I said planted, because now I'm around a lot of Chicago people again, and all my A's are flattening out.
Thank you.
Right?
Take that as a compliment.
No, it is. It's a huge compliment.
I said got it to somebody the other day, and they're like, oh, you're from Chicago.
Yeah.
Got
to go to Domino's and get some Jay's potato chips.
Right.
Get the car out of the garage.
Right.
Front room.
So you did theater, and then how did you end up...
Well, for me, it was when I was growing up. It was like Bill Murray and those guys, mm-hmm. and I knew that Bill was a Second City guy. And so even in college, when I was in theater school in college, I had sort of pointed my arrow and said, when I get out of college, I'm going back, because I grew up in Chicago, so I'm going to go move downtown and I'm going to get into Second City, because that's what Bill Murray did to get to Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. So it was always, it was, you know, the map.
Right.
Like, I've always been, like, destination-oriented. Like, mm-hmm. I want to get here. What's the route that I have to do? If I want to be on Saturday Night Live, I'm going to do what Bill did, and that's, I'm going to go study with Del Close, and I'm going to go study at Second City, and I'll get into Second City, and that'll get me on Saturday Night Live.
And when, what was your experience studying? Because everyone has a different experience with Del Close. What was your experience with Del Close? And you're smiling, because my guess is it wasn't that great of an experience.
Well, it was a very short period of time, but it was very... What was great about Del is he nurtured your sense of the absurd in a wonderful way.
But let's be honest. He was not a nurturing guy. I mean, I learned a hell of a lot from him. But his approach was that, because you had worked with Martin DeMont, you'd also worked with Don DePaolo, right? Those guys were a different breed. Yeah. Tell us about Del.
Del, you know, you would do a scene and Del would just go, well, what the hell kind of lame-ass choice was that? And so you go, and he would just kind of beat you up. Or it would just be kind of whatever his whims of experimentation were. It's like he for a month worth of classes, he would have us, it's like, what if you caught mimes, like a disease, and you caught mimes, and mimes would follow you around mocking you wherever you went. And for a month, we would do scenes with somebody shadowing you, mocking your every move. And then after a month of that, he goes, well, that was neither here nor there. We didn't get anything out of that. What else? And then he would just sort of change direction and want to do something else. And he would berate you. So that when you would get a day where he's going, your work is getting really smart, you'd go, thanks, Dad. Yeah, so it was tough love.
So you studied at IO with Del.
Yeah.
And then you get hired by Second City.
Yeah, to tour.
Okay,
yeah.
So you were in a touring company.
Mm-hmm. Toured for 2.5 years. Then I, the touring company that I was in, then I went to Detroit and pinched hit in Second City Detroit. Mm-hmm. Colin Ferguson had wanted to go back to school and they brought me in and I was there for 4 months in Second City Detroit. Then I came back and did Second City Northwest. And then they took the Northwest cast and we went to Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the last thing that I did. And I understudied main stage in the middle of all that.
Because I remember, I think the first time I knew you was during Northwest. Was Annoyance? How was it at Annoyance?
I think you were doing a one-man show at Annoyance.
I was, yeah.
And that's when
you
came on my radar.
Okay.
Because I was sitting in the back going, God, he's smart. He has such access. Right. He has such access.
What does that mean?
You have access. Like some people just have access. Like, you know, it's like the Matrix. You just call shit up in your mind, and you can just grab it and say it and have it for you at the ready.
Well, I think I've lost that.
That's fair.
But thank you for the compliment. Mm-hmm. So I knew you when you were at Northwest, and you were in that company. It was like Keckner, Pat Finn.
No, Finn was not there. It was Keckner, it was Matt Dwyer, Nancy Walls, Teresa Mulligan, and myself.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you had gotten, there was a lot of heat, and I'm going to say that because that was about being on Saturday Night Live.
A lot of our cast were brought, the SNL casting people came to see the Northwest show,
mm-hmm.
And then kind of grabbed a handful of us to go and audition for Lorne. Well, Lorne came out to see us,
mm-hmm.
Lorne Michaels, and then brought us out to New York to audition, and we stood where the host gives his monologue, and it was one of those where the producers were like, you might want to start looking for an apartment in New York. And I was like, great, great. And then I went back to Chicago, and the sweater just started unraveling, and the phone call stopped coming, and I didn't get the job. But
how did you take that?
It was hard.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, it was hard because it was, again, like you draw the map, and so far the map was working. It was like, I'm gonna get hired at Second City. Done. I'm gonna get up for SNL. Done. Oh, done. Like it's done. It's done. And yeah, that was hard. That was young. I was 27.
And so, what did you decide? You don't get any Saturday Night Live. Do you decide, okay, I'm gonna do another show at Second City?
No. What I decided was, if SNL is knocking, obviously I'm swimming in a bigger pool now.
Now, here's the thing that I like about you, okay? And I don't know necessarily if it was received in Chicago as well, but you had confidence. Would you agree to that?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Would you say that confidence in Chicago can rub some people the wrong way?
Sure.
Okay. Where did you get that confidence? Because nobody at 27 years old, they get a shot at Saturday Night Live, they don't make it. You're at Northwest. If you play your cards right, you do another show or two at Northwest, you may get ETC, you may get Main Stage. You decide to go to New York.
Yeah.
What's inside you to make that move?
Well, a huge thing was my parents, obviously, they're always very supportive of whatever route. And I sealed off the exits. Like, I didn't have a double major. It was like, this is what I'm going to do. And I had enough positive strokes to be able to withstand any negativity. So the fact that I didn't get SNL was a blow, but the fact that I was up for SNL was a boon. So the boon was enough for me to go, okay, I could go back, but I already know what Chicago is, and I already know what that is. I don't know what New York is, and I know that now a network television show is interested deeply to the point where they, you know, flew me out. And,
but if you think about this, Todd, when we were doing improv and stuff like that, people stayed for a long time.
Yes.
People stayed for 10 years.
Yes.
It's changed now because I think people are being exposed with improv in high school and probably even grade school now, and they get it in college. So by the time they come to Chicago, they've had 7 or 8 years. But we were like in an artist colony. You stayed for 10 years. But you decide you go to New York. I think that's a huge thing, especially at a young age.
It was, and I think, at a certain point in Chicago, you have three choices. You're either going to stay in Chicago, you're going to move to L.A., or you're going to move to New York.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to add New York to my life resume,
right,
even if it wasn't, like, career-wise, mm-hmm, because I just wanted to live in New York and see what that was
there
like.
There was also a thing that that I wasn't aware of, that you got mugged in Chicago, and that changed some stuff. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah. I was 23 years old. 24. I was in my early 20s.
Uh-huh.
In Chicago, and I had just done a Northwest, no, a touring coach show. And it was a beautiful, like, February night, and it was huge, like, downy flakes, and I was kind of dating one of our stage manager, Dawn. And I had dropped
her. What do you mean, kind of dating?
It was just the infancy. No.
Okay, okay.
No, it was
Why
like
do you
just,
say that, like, no? Like,
no, we weren't fucking.
Okay.
Is that a bad thing?
You're not supposed to date, you sleep with the stage manager?
I don't know. I never got that far, so I never had to deal with that.
Okay.
That information.
Okay.
But what it was we had just were kissing I was dropping off the Belmont L stop. I'm like, I'm gonna walk home because it's 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
It's a beautiful night. So I walk home, and I'm walking down Clark Street, and a guy comes around the corner, and then two guys come around the corner, and his buddy comes, and then this guy comes, and he comes behind me, and then this guy stands in front of me, and he shows me his gun. I can see my apartment building, I've had a lot of caffeine. He goes, come around the corner. And he says to his buddy, you got your gun? And I'm like, okay, so now they have two guns at me. And they walk me around the corner. And now he's pointing the gun in my head. And then I go, if you take your hands, and I don't know how many people in this room have had been held at gunpoint, but not an everyday experience in my life.
What are you, with this going down, what's going on in your head?
Well, I was going to say, if you take your hands and you put them in front of your ears and you talk, that's what my own voice sounded like to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, it was coming, I just was babbling.
Is your heart beating? You feel like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and this moment is taking forever.
Okay.
And so I'm going, what do you want, what do you want, what do you want? And he goes, just give me your wallet. I'm like, gladly. And I had a bag from the show, and I had a shoulder bag with my Second City suit, and I go, anything else? And he goes, give me the bags. And I go, boom, boom. And then I go, anything else? And he goes, yeah, run, motherfucker. And I go, and my legs took off out from under me, and they grabbed my stuff, and they went that way. And the joke being they opened it up and found funny wigs and glasses.
And then for the next month, people were getting robbed in Lincoln Park with funny wigs and glasses.
Yes, they were the wig bandit.
Yes.
But they'd ask for a location, which was weird.
Do you know those guys actually got on a Herald team at IO?
Yeah, they have a deal with Comedy Central.
Yeah, yeah.
So it changed the course of their life as well.
How did it change the course of your life?
To put it in the most dramatic terms.
Please, please.
The most dramatic terms, I died. I died at 23.
What part of you died?
In the best way, meaning everything else is cake. He could have flipped out and pulled the trigger. Mm-hmm. And so that would have been my ticket. Mm-hmm. That's it. And so in so many ways, it just made me a lot more fearless than I was. Because I was like, shit, that could have been it. That could have been it. So now it's all just cake. I'm alive now, and I could get hit by a bus. Somebody else could shoot me. I could, a meteor. I don't know. But now it's there's a bit more relish to everything, and a bit more, why not do it now? Why not kiss that girl at the Belmont L stop now? Because walking home, you could get shot in the head. So I would hate to have not kissed her and been shot in the head,
This is what I find fascinating, and this is not how my mind works. You talk about Saturday Night Live, and you talk about...
He hated that story.
Okay.
Like, I am done. They're swearing.
Right. You get close to Saturday Night Live, and most people would say, oh, I was so close to Saturday Night Live.
Really hated it.
I know,
he did.
But,
getting out.
They would have said, I didn't get into Saturday Night Live, I was so close, oh... And kind of go into a depression.
Sure.
You look at it as a positive. Most people who get held up at gunpoint would be like, oh my God, I can't believe I got held up at gunpoint. I don't know where people are going.
I know. They don't like guns. It's a very anti-gun town.
Yeah. But you look at it as a positive.
Right.
Have you always had that?
I think so.
Where did that come from?
I think it came from my mom.
And your mom...
My mom, without going into too much detail, suffered a lot of adversity
as a child.
Like as a child, just
abuse?
A bad stepfather.
Okay.
Like that. Yet, the most super, I grew up, it was hayrides and carving pumpkins. And, she was going to make sure that we had the antithesis of a lot of the things that she, there was no swearing in my house. It wasn't puritanical, it was positive. Mm-hmm. It was celebrate, family, joy, you can be anything you want to be, as long as you're being nice to people and having a good time. It was very, very positive, and it's, if you want to be an actor, then that's what you should go be. And I think for myself, early on as a kid, I was not an athletic kid, so I had to be funny if I was going to meet girls. And so... And I think the nature of comedy, the nature of being a clown is like stepping in a bucket, sighing, picking yourself up, and keep walking. There's probably another bucket, but you got to keep walking, And I think I couldn't tell you if that's the exact answer of where the positivity came from. It's just something I've just had. I also have a massive degree of perspective, I think, in that I go, there are actual problems in the world. Real problem. That sounds hokey, but when I go, I was held at gunpoint, and yet people in countries have the school bombed next to them and don't know if they're going to make it home from work because their life is a war zone. So it's relative. Yeah, I got held up, and that was scary for me, but it ain't what a lot of people go through, And so I feel very fortunate often and very blessed often with the circumstances of my life, and then you try to continue to spin those into more positive. Because, like, what's the alternative? What's the alternative? It's just you know, Samuel Beckett-like misery. Like, you could go, you could just knit your brow in an existential angst of all of it, or you could go, well, I'm dead already. I'm dead already. I get 80 years at tops, and the last five ain't going to be great. So, or I could get hit by a bus, you know, on Congress. I don't know.
So how do you use that positivity into your improv?
Well, it's all yes, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all joy of discovery, and it's all delight and play.
Do you still, after all these years, feel joy and delight doing it?
Yeah.
And what is it about it?
It's silly, and it's freeing, and it's absurd, and it's social. I did stand up when I was like 19, and it was crushingly lonely in terms of being on stage by yourself and dependent on hope my material works, and the guys that are good at it are ninjas. I have always liked kind of the bare canvas of, we're going out for an hour and I just don't know what's going to happen, and I'll tell you after that hour what happened, and the joy of the play of it all.
How has it changed since when you did it, when you started out in your 20s and now you're doing it close to late 40s?
Mid
40s. You're in LA, so it's early 40s. But if you were in Chicago, yeah.
46, yeah. Almost. It's early 40s. I'm just breaking the late 30s. what's changed for me is, like, I think you know, when I was a kid, when I was 23 and getting hired to the touring company, I had something to prove. Mm-hmm. And now, like, just the amount of battle scars and shows and stuff that I've done, I have no agenda hitting the stage.
What do you mean by that?
I have no...
What did you... When you were 23, what was your agenda?
You would have... And especially, I think, in Chicago, there was... And at the time, wanting to get seen by... Mm-hmm. And wanting to get hired by... And wanting to get put on that Herald team. And so I had to make sure that I was funny. So you do playwright. And you do script stuff. And I think I've explored so many premises already and that I just don't care anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't care what the scene is going to be, because it's just going to be. Mm-hmm. And I don't care if it sucks, because at worst, it'll still be interesting. Mm-hmm. You know?
What kind of... Because we're going to improvise now, you and I. What kind of improv do you like to do today? Because you do all sorts of genres and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think... I prefer freeform.
Okay, what is that?
That is you know, when I started working with Burr Manhattan back in 96, the first thing we threw out was no longer taking suggestions.
Okay.
Where we and then starting physically. Because the danger of going into one's head, for me, was jumping to words too quickly, mm-hmm. which would put me into a playwriting situation. Mm-hmm. And it was easier if I could ground it physically and find the discovery between what we're doing,
okay,
as opposed to jumping out with a who, what, where, the first three lines of dialogue. You know what I mean? That found it constricting.
So how would you start with Burn Manhattan? If we did a Burn Manhattan style scene, what would that look
there like? There would be music first. Okay. The music would drive us into some sort of spatial exploration, which would land into some sort of activity, which would then tell us who the characters were and where they were and what they were doing, and then we would go from there.
Okay. I'm not going to say anything this time. Just do what you want.
What I want what I want is for me not to have to move out again. That's what I want.
Roy, it's over. We've gone over this. We went to couples therapy for the last 3 years and it didn't work.
By didn't work, you mean I shouldn't throw plates. But sometimes I have to. It's just who I am, Donald.
That is the first time you used my proper name in the last 4 years.
Because Don is a guy that owns a garage, and you don't own a garage.
You always wanted better for me, didn't you?
Yes. Yes. Because you clearly didn't. You clearly didn't. You were comfortable settling, and I am not. Oh.
Those are your books.
Then why are you closing them closer to yourself?
Because I want to have something to remind me of you.
Then you could say, Roy, can I have your books? Instead of just take.
Roy, can I have your books?
Yes.
Why do you make everything so complicated?
I don't, but you're a thief!
You
do! You were a thief!
A thief. You know what a thief would have... When you turned your back, I would have taken them. I did it right in front of your face.
That's the thing. You're such a good thief. You take right in front of me, and you'll take, and you'll just take, and you just take, and you take, and then I have nothing left. Well, I have Billy Joel's The Stranger.
Go ahead and take it. Go ahead and take it, because I have the turntable, okay?
Oh, this is what... Okay.
You know, I'm hurt.
I see that.
Roy, I'm hurt.
I'm the one
who tried to make it work.
I know.
I'm putting the blender over in my corner.
Well, at least you're announcing it. That is a step in the right direction. Because before couples therapy, you just would have taken it.
Because I've learned how to communicate.
And I haven't?
No, you haven't.
What are we doing right now for the first time since last February?
How about this? Look at this. Look at this refrigerator. You just write things in sticky notes.
Mm-hmm.
Need milk.
We did?
You're a jerk.
You are?
Eggs? Question mark.
I don't want you to eat them anymore.
That's how you communicate? I have to guess what the sticky note said?
It was more like eggs.
You're nuts. Do you know that?
Yes. Yes, but you need a little nuts.
No, I don't.
No, you need everything. No. You need eggs spelled out for you. You need it all. You need ice packs.
Don't be taking the ice packs. Leave them there. I
don't need them.
What would happen if something happened and you took them out, you put your hands on them, and they have germs on them?
Well, guess what? It's not going to be a problem anymore because I'm not living here anymore. And that was your decision. So you can keep your ice packs. And I will keep Billy Joel's The Stranger. And I will keep Fleetwood Mac. And I will keep Boston. No, you can have Boston.
What do you got over in my pile? You know, when we first met, you were a lot of fun.
I'm still a lot of fun. You just stopped looking.
Whiskers is staying with me.
Can I have a sec?
Sure.
They'll take good care of you.
I'm not falling for the guilt. I am not falling for your pathetic self-pity shit. I'm not. It's not gonna happen. I don't care what kind of face you make, it's not gonna happen. Stop it right now. It's not gonna happen. Okay, we can split them. Weekends. Every other weekend you can have them, but that is it. That is, okay, you know what? Take them tonight, and I'll come tomorrow. Okay, you can have them for a month. That's it. And then it's every other weekend. You are so fucking manipulated. You always get your way with me. You know that.
If I was getting my way, I wouldn't be leaving.
I'm making a mistake.
Whoa, that's going on the fridge. That's a first.
Okay.
So it was working?
Yes.
and I'm filled with mistakes. I'm a pinata of mistakes, but I want your stick to beat me open.
And I want to be that stick that beats you open. And then the prize is just
rain down on you. Rain down on you, but just don't.
Try to control it.
Don't hit so hard next time.
I
love you, Don.
I love you too, Roy.
Let's put on that Billy Joel one. On our turntable.
On our turntable.
It's 5 o'clock on a Saturday. The regular crowd shuffles in.
All right. All right, so what did you think of that scene?
I had a blast.
What did you have a blast doing?
I like having the time that we don't feel the rush to do, like, just going, I don't know.
Right.
That was fun.
So because the people that are listening to the podcast aren't going to know what we did for the first 60 seconds.
No.
So can you just describe what we did?
You put your hands out, and you didn't know, for whatever reason, you just did it.
Mm-hmm.
I mirrored it. I then came in and kind of mirror complimented what you were doing with the shape you were making with your hands.
So it was almost like a ball.
It was a ball or some object that we then gave shape to.
Right.
And we put it down. So we were mutually engaged in a physical activity of putting something down, which then became a box of something. And then I mirrored the putting down of a box by putting something else beside it.
Right.
And then that inspired you to think about moving of something, and then the scene begins.
Right.
So we didn't need a suggestion, and then we just had immediate history,
mm-hmm.
which was the fun part.
Right.
And then finding what's in the boxes and around.
What I liked, what you did was you then off that you embodied an emotion. You came in with a very strong emotion, which gave me something to play off of.
But you already, you charged it immediately by making it about leaving, which is already emotionally charged. So I just reflected that and then took it higher.
Because I felt I could have either matched your energy, but I felt I wanted to be a little more emotionally invested in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like if I could have done that over, I would have been a little more emotionally invested.
But we didn't know what it was yet. So by the fact that you were just introducing a bit of information,
mm-hmm.
and then I, you know, when we... There's mirror compliment and mirror copy for me, and that's a Marty DeMott thing.
Right.
And
well, explain it for people that don't
right.
know the concept.
Mirror compliment mirror copy is do what your partner's doing exactly, which is what we were doing with the box.
So let's just give an example. What would that look like?
So you're crying. Okay, that's mirror copy. I'm crying, you're crying.
Right.
Cry. Yeah. Hey, take that!
Stop throwing things at me!
I do what I want. I'm a thrower of things. So the more he cries, the more I throw stuff. The more you throw stuff, or the more you cry, the more I throw stuff.
I'm heightening the crying.
Right. I'm the reason you're doing it, and you're the reason that I'm doing it.
Right.
I'm enjoying watching you cry. You cry because I'm throwing things.
Right.
And so we provide the reason mm-hmm. the other person is doing it, and therefore it holds your partner up, and it allows you to stand on
you're
the
doing what Martin used to do, remember?
Probably.
Martin used to do the Saeed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so when you had sort of a terse, angry approach.
Which is how I look at life.
And
I was like, I want to make a positive choice, because I always go to that negative. Can we do just the top of the scene again, and I make a positive choice on this?
Yeah.
Okay, is that going to...
Mm-hmm.
So, what was my first line? Do you remember?
You said... does anybody remember what you said? Something about you don't have to leave, or you're moving, or something. It was something about leaving.
Okay, I'll just say, we'll just make it up.
Okay.
And I'm going to make a positive choice this time.
And I'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Okay.
Okay.
Billy Joel. Okay.
You're leaving.
Finally.
Roy, you're finally leaving.
I can't believe
it. I can't believe it either.
The thing is, I'm scared.
I know. I'm scared too.
I've never... it's going to be good. It's going to be good. It's we both need this. We both
yes,
need this.
Yes, yes, we need this.
But
we
you know why? You know why? Because you would never do it alone.
No, no, I wouldn't. No. I've been riding on your coattails for so long.
And so this is going to be healthy.
It's going to be great. It's going to be great. You're going to Manhattan.
I am?
Yes.
By the way!
Yeah.
Big city, here I come.
It's going to be so good.
Yeah.
Oh, I noticed some of my records.
Take them. Whatever you want is yours.
They're just not in the box.
I know. I wanted to keep some.
Oh, you might want to tell me.
Okay. I just, they're in the bedroom. I just...
Breadcrumbs? You don't have to...
I just wanted to hook up.
You can say goodbye.
Okay, okay. I just wanted one, you know.
One more,
yeah. Yeah.
You don't mind.
Yeah.
Can I put on Cabaret?
Go right ahead. You're going to be so great out in New York.
I think so.
Yeah. Because you know what? You have been the best actor here. Cabaret. That's Cabaret. Welcome, monsieur. Yeah.
The calm and the avenue. The calm. The calm and étranger. Stranger.
I don't have a reservation. I'm going to miss you.
I'm going to miss you, but you're going to come visit. Wait, you sigh right after.
Well, I don't know. I just think you're going to go to New York, you're going to meet some friends, you're going to do coke, you're going to get a couple tattoos, and then the next thing you know, you're not going to know who I am.
That's how you...
Yeah.
That's how you see me.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go get my records.
Roy, it's not about you. The last guy I dated, that Stu, that's what happened.
Yeah.
You went to L.A.
Did you smash Olive Stew's records, too?
Just the stuff in the 80s.
My Aha and my Duran Duran.
Yeah.
You're lucky I have these on CD. This is how you were going to send me off?
Take me.
Take you with me?
Yeah.
Take you with me?
Take you. I know you only have a studio. I know you only have a studio, but...
Yeah, but you know... This was as much about me. Me breaking out.
I know, but I'm thinking about it, and I'm like, you going? I'm like, fuck, I can't make it.
What are you gonna do in New York?
It's no problem.
This is gonna be good for both of us.
No, I can transfer. I already talked to work.
You've already talked to work?
Yes, there's a Walgreens there, and I can transfer like no problem. I'd have to start at the photo department and be an assistant manager, but I know I can work my way up to manager. I'm willing to put it all away. Roy, come on. You've gotten this far because of me.
I'm gonna have to say no. I'm gonna have to say I have to do this. I'm gonna have to say maybe I need to get coked up, tattooed, and forget you.
And maybe I need to smash all your fucking records.
Smash away.
That's how you want us to go?
CD. No, that's how you want us to go. You introduced record smashing. I didn't. We were having a lovely evening, drinking Shiraz, and packing, and listening to Liza. And then
I love you, Roy.
And I love you, and that's why I have to go.
Could you explain that part?
I'm going to leave you here alone in your apartment amongst my smashed Howard Jones to figure that out.
See, great job. Now, what did you experience differently we did this the second time?
Here's why I like both of them.
Okay, please.
Because for me, what makes a scene is the fact that there is a turn.
Okay.
The first scene started negative and turned positive at the end. this scene started positive and turned negative to the, at the end, and therefore there was a journey of these characters.
Okay.
So to me, it felt whole and successful. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end. It had an emotional journey for both of us, between both of them. I don't have a preference.
Okay. I liked the second one better because I felt, and you couldn't pick it up in the podcast, you can pick it up here, I was more active, I felt, and more engaged with what you were. I think the first one, I was almost trying to figure it out and trying too hard.
Okay.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna have some questions for
okay.
the audience to ask you. If we could just turn the house lights up, and if you could, who's got a question for Todd? Great, right here.
When it comes to the physicality of a scene, is the physicality leading the scene for you, or is it something that you feel the scene and then you kind of build around that?
Do you start with the physicality and then it drives it?
My feeling is, and the phrase that I've used is, your mind can wander, but your body's always in the space. And if I continue to engage my body in connecting to the space, it does this little trick, which is it keeps me in the scene. If I pick up a glass of wine, it keeps me from, as Marty used to say, Charlie on your shoulder going, don't say that, don't do that, that's stupid. If I'm continuing to be connected to the environment and to what I'm doing and kind of seeing what's there, I'm always reconnected back into the scene and the character, and there's items, and the room expanded, and there was more places to go, and I didn't know the records would be smashed till I got back there. Like, that stuff is really fun for me because it makes it I don't have to decide anything. I feel like it's decided for me. I walked into his room and, like the Matrix, looked down on the bed and saw all my records smashed up.
So you're almost... That helps you make discoveries versus invention.
Yeah, I don't feel like I'm inventing anything.
And the other thing I had never heard before, and I studied with Marty too, mm-hmm. Martin DeMott, that it quiets that critic in our head, which is interesting.
Object work and environment. Mm-hmm. It does, because when you're giving attention to the shape and size of an object, that is an investment. And judgment and speech live in the same place in your brain, as well as if I'm engaging this, then that it's like giving it a little Sudoku to keep it busy, to give that judgment, so that if I'm invested in this object, I could just sit here on stage and not say a word and then just slowly just drink down a bottle of wine and feel invested in the moment and the environment.
But it's interesting, and I have to say, almost, I don't know, 30 years of improvising and then 15 of teaching or so, mm-hmm. Object work is something that keeps getting lost in the generations. Why do you think that is?
Because what nobody hires object work. Saturday Night Live and Comedy Central don't hire object work. They hire writers and funny people. And I think the Darwinian nature of that which gets promoted into Second City, gets promoted into Saturday Night Live or Comedy Central, is wit. Verbal wit. And I think if you can go on stage and cerebrally just talk your way through a scene with jokes landing, mm-hmm. and that sort of mental gymnastic, it's promoted. And so Darwinian, like, so the people that keep getting moved up tend to be ninjas at the verbal, mm-hmm. because it ends up getting them jobs as writers and as performers, lucrative in the career. And so I would say Second City, you know, any improv house that pays will often reward really funny people, really verbally funny people. And then the industry rewards really verbally funny people. And then the physical theater still lives in Europe in clown and all in that world, and has it, and it is financially rewarded there, mm-hmm. because there's touring shows and whatnot. Bill Irwin and all those guys that tour overseas with their clowns with their physical theater, that's financially rewarded over there, and so you get a whole lot of people pursuing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, another question, right over here.
When you're working with an ensemble of people that use physicality that way, mm-hmm. I know in the very brief pieces of education that I've had on it, there seems to be patterns that emerge when you're trying to organically discover movement to inspire whatever. You've been working with these people a really long time. How do you guys move out of the patterns you establish for yourself.
Are you saying like almost like you're working with the same people and they're making the same choices over and over again?
Maybe so. I just don't know how that works with physicality, because I know that bringing premises to scenes, that improviser plays a mother a lot. Things like that happen where you put yourself in the same roles. I don't know if that happens when inspiring physically.
Well, inspiring physically to me goes back to what I was saying earlier about having no agenda. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going, hey, let's do a couple's breakup scene. Oh, I can't wait to try that out.
Right.
I was just looking at what we were physically doing, and that's what inspired the scene. And you can always, like, you could do something tiny, like you can do something huge physically, and it's going to continue to inspire different kind of scene work. Just doing something abstract physically can suddenly give you a costume. And the costume can then give you a character from that, and then your partners can reflect that and know where they are, just based on I don't know why I'm doing this gesture. I'm just going to step out and do it. But then suddenly I notice it suddenly makes a cape, or it makes a bustle, and then suddenly we're on a train bound for the West. And I didn't know that going in, and I'm a rural coquette seeking her fortune. you know what I'm saying? So physically, inspiring something physically eliminates my need to come up with premises. Because the premises that I feel, and I've often referred to this to improv as a beast that tells you what it wants to eat. And so then I feel the moment is telling me what character I'm going to play, as opposed to me deciding on it before, or standing at a back line, shifting weight, staring at the ground, thinking of something. So, oh, and I got something, now I'll enter. I don't care what I'm entering with, I'll just enter with something physically, and that'll tell me what I'm doing.
So you will not come in with a character.
No.
You will come in with physicality, and you'll make the discovery off the physicality.
Mm-hmm.
What about working off your partner?
Well, if I see my partner, if the initiation
takes
from
them. Let's
say
I'm doing this. I'm eating a bowl of cereal.
And then I can mirror compliment you and pour more milk.
Okay.
Am I your butler? Am I your wife? I don't know. We'll figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
But I will be inspired by what you're doing physically and then figure out who I am.
You've never come in with a character.
Well, maybe if it's called for.
But
I'm not going to say never.
Right, I mean, but that's not how you work.
I will enter with a character if a character is required by my partner.
Right. But well, let's say 80% of the time, you're coming in totally
just,
blank with something physical and then reacting.
Yeah.
Great. Another question for Todd. Right over here.
Just in terms of piggybacking on the question that was just asked in terms of repetition or styles or whatever of, you know, routines of movement or whatever, thinking back to your time in New York and the different spaces that you worked in, how did the spaces that you worked in, like the theaters, influence? So I know you worked at Nada on Loveless.
This is Matt Higgins from my group in New York.
Okay.
So he's got my resume at the ready.
Okay.
At the House of Candles, and, at One Dream Theater, in the kitchen. And
keep going. Chelsea Playhouse.
Now, Matt, were you in the shows too?
Yes,
yeah.
It was. And
okay.
Each one of these spaces was so unique. For example, the Nada, the ceiling. You could, you know, we could stand. Todd and I could pull.
We did. Matt and I did one show where the ceiling was so low we were cockroaches, and the rest of the troupe could lift us and we could crawl across the ceiling. And then another great example of how the space often will dictate what you're doing, we were doing a show at a bar called Hell. And I'm not kidding. And we asked the guy, we got there and we said, where are we performing? He goes, over there. And it was a crowded bar floor. And we literally had to move people into like a 4x4 inch square.
So people were standing?
They're right next to us with drinks. So we had to, so we did scenes by lifting each other up, and the scene would be these two actors up here so that the people in the back could see, and we puppeted them around like the Muppets so that they could see the show. And so that, and then we did another show at the opening of the tunnel where they didn't turn off the music, the tunnel. They didn't turn off the music. So it was like, we need you to turn down the music. And it was like, like that. And we're like, well, I guess we're doing a completely silent show because we can't use dialogue. So we did a completely silent show.
So what do you learn from those experiences? The bar, the nightclub.
Mm-hmm.
What do you learn as an improviser doing those kind of shows?
That this work is liquid and it can fit into any shape decanter.
Mm-hmm. How does it make those shows make you better? Because a lot of people, like myself, would go back and go, oh, fuck, we're never doing that place again. They don't appreciate the art form. This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to do whatever. How does it? How has that made you better?
We rose to the challenge, and now, you know, the elasticity of where the work can go is huge. The fact that we can do it, we can do a set in a crowded bar lifting each other. The fact that we can do a completely silent set because of the club music. The fact that we can play a room that is massive or play a tiny space. You just go, that's what we do. We make theater out of thin air based on the restrictions of the moment. And that's what we do.
You've booked a lot of stuff. I mean, you have a lot of credits. Okay, and you were saying, I said, you have a lot of credits. You go, yeah, I have a lot of credits, but it's one-time thing.
Yeah, I move around just like that.
Right.
I move from show to show to show.
So what is your secret? Because I'm, I guess, envious. I wouldn't say jealous, but I would definitely say, maybe there's a little jealousy. Anyone who's worked as much as you. What is your secret of booking so much?
I have devastatingly green eyes.
No, seriously.
And we were talking briefly. I think because between the theater training and doing Sam Shepard and Arthur Miller and all that in college, and then all the Second City and improv and Bermanhattan training, I am very comfortable in either medium. Mm-hmm. So I could go and do Law and Order, CSI, Supernatural, Buffy, all that, and then I could do Dharma and Greg, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and all that. So there's never a genre that I couldn't plug myself into.
But we were talking backstage. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that come from Chicago. They've worked for, you know, they've gotten the comedy chops down. They go to L.A. and they can't make that leap into drama.
I also don't know if they're trying to.
But what I'm hearing from you is to do it. If you want to go to L.A., you got to diversify. You can't just be on the comedy side of the street. Is that true?
No. What I'm saying is, I may, if I had locked in and just said only comedy, I could potentially have streamlined my career like Vince Vaughn. You know what I'm saying? Like, and gone bum 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 and just locked in. Eddie Izzard, who I was working on a show with,
The Riches.
He had said to me, he's like, he kept saying, you've got to pick a lane. You've got to pick a lane. He's like, you know, comedy or drama, that's how it's going to work for you. And because he had picked comedy for so long, and then he could decide he wanted to get into drama.
Right.
And he's like saying, pick one and then you'll move further faster. It's just not as interesting to me. It's more interesting because right now I'm working on 12 Monkeys to go and do that and be a badass in a post-apocalyptic show and then go and do a show like Curb. It's more interesting to me to be able to do all of it.
And 12 Monkeys, can you tell us, because that's coming out.
That'll
right?
be, the series will premiere in January. I booked a recurring role on that. It's on the Sci-Fi Channel, and it is a television adaptation of the Terry Gilliam.
Because you're like a big, I mean, going all the way back to mm-hmm. a kid, you were into Star Wars. You're like a big sci-fi guy.
Big,
you go to Comic-Con and stuff like that. And what happens, who are you representing when you go to Comic-Con? What shows?
No shows. When I go to Comic-Con, I write a web comic online called Devil Inside.
Okay.
And so I'm usually there hawking that and selling that. Now, I happen to have done a lot of the genre shows, mm-hmm. so I kind of become a walking billboard for whatever show that person was a fan of. Oh, you're the guy from
Supernatural. What's the weirdest thing that ever happened at Comic-Con?
Oh, Jesus.
Because it's weird, isn't it?
It's weird. We call it, my collaborator on the comic calls it Nerdy Gras. just pick one. I don't know because it's all weird to say there's one isolated incident of weird. My favorite moment, and it isn't even weird, and I even took a picture of it, was a woman dressed as, she was dressed as Slave Leia.
And Slave Leia.
Princess Leia from the I'm nerd shorthand.
Yeah.
Those out there know what I'm talking about. But she's dressed as Princess Leia from Jabba's barge with the metal bikini. And she was standing there, like, trading info with a guy in full stormtrooper garb. Like they were, they both had their cell phones out and they were giving each other, like, what party are you going to be at? It was like this, only here. Only here. I would hope only there. Because I can't imagine just like in the middle of Manhattan, a woman just walking around dressed as Slave Leia would be weird.
Where does the science fiction nerd and the improv comedy nerd come together for you?
As a writer, probably more than anything else. Because when I write with like the video game or the comic, I had written a pilot for the Sci-Fi Channel, an outer space pilot. The writing process for me is like doing an improv scene, you know, while you're on the computer making it happen. And the stuff I tend to write genre horror science fiction, but it always has a darkly humorous bend to it. So more as an actor, when I'm doing those shows, I'm relying tons on my improv.
Now, the other thing I love about you is I'm on Facebook. I'm on it less because it was time, because people were... I was posting stuff that was way too personal to other people, but I follow your Facebook page a lot. You do not have any apologies for promoting stuff.
No.
Now, most improvisers don't go there. They're afraid to promote themselves. What is it about you? You will promote constantly. I'm here, I'm at Comic-Con, look at the crowd, stuff like that. Why is that important today for people to do that?
Well, it's the Wild West now. So the internet is a chance. Like, a lot of the people that I'm fortunate enough to be, that are interested in what I'm doing, don't even live. They're in Australia and they're in England, and because of a lot of the shows that I'm on have, like the originals, the Vampire Diaries spin-off, they have a fan base that are overseas. And so in order for me to connect with them and hopefully build readership for the comic that I put out, that is my, like, social media pretty much exists for
but
that.
But you'll say, oh, I just did a day on blah, blah, blah show.
Yeah.
Now, how is that?
It's that is my public life.
Right.
Like, what I don't really do is put up pictures of my kids.
Okay.
And I don't put up pictures of... Occasionally I have. But for the most part, like, if I go to Disneyland, that's me and my family. Mm-hmm. And I'll maybe post a picture, but my kids won't really be in it.
So what would you say to people that are in groups? Mm-hmm. They're actors, comics, improvisers, about promoting yourself and why it's important?
Because nobody else is really going to do it for you until they are. Mm-hmm. Nobody else is. Like, I don't want to do this stuff in a vacuum. I don't want to whistle in the wind.
But what about, okay, our peer group is like, oh, God, if Todd puts one more thing about this
or that. I'm not doing it for them.
Now, how have you gotten there where you don't care about anything?
Why would I care that some improviser somewhere who, if he's mad that I'm putting up, I'm not putting up pictures at Comic-Con for a fellow improviser. I'm putting the pictures up for the fans of the comic that I write or the show that I was working on.
Do you think that's part of your success? Like, you don't care what other people think?
Oh, yeah.
How did you get there? Because it's something I struggle with.
I could point a gun at your head.
I will take you up next time you're in Chicago. We'll meet at the Belmont Elks.
Done. And we'll make out.
Yes.
First. And then I'll sneak around the corner.
And I will make sure I get a second city bag and a suit and then get some money along. Before we go, this has been just a blast.
That's
You've
fun.
Been a great sport. What advice would you give somebody starting out today in improv?
Do it for the love of the game. But don't be afraid to be ambitious, but don't be ambitious first. And realize, and I say this to any actor, anybody going into a performance, it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. So so let the success come in the doing of the thing, not necessarily always where it's going to get you.
Okay, and then I'm going to throw this out, and maybe if you don't want to answer this. I would have said when I knew you in Chicago, and you were ambitious first, and you didn't do it for the fun. Would that be a fair assessment, and that's how you learn this? In your 20s?
In my early 20s, I had my eyes firmly on the prize, but I was doing it for the fun. I wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't for the fun.
Okay.
But I wanted the fun to be a living.
Right. Okay.
Right?
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I loved it. I love when we go back sometimes and we we replay or we re-improvise a scene. I always get so much out of that. I also learn so much redoing that. So I really appreciate Todd having the patience and doing that with me. I also love the story about him getting mugged in Chicago. So I want to thank our guest, Todd Stashwick, for being such a wonderful guest. And check out Gotham. I've heard only great things about the show. It's a prequel to, I believe, to Batman. So check that out. I want to thank Dave Buckman again, the guy who brought me down here in Austin. And I want to thank all the good people here at the Out of Bounds Comedy Festival for just treating me like improv royalty. I really, really, really appreciate it. Also, I want to thank my producer here in Chicago, Dan Schiffmacher, for making this episode sound slick, so slick and so professional. And if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my classes and my books and the Improv Nerd t-shirt, but more importantly, the Improv blog. Each week, I will send you a new blog that will make you a better improviser. Go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. Also, we're taking over social media. So like Improv Nerd on Facebook. It really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd, and go to our YouTube channel, Improv Nerd. So check that out. Also, we're on Feral Audio. That is a wonderful podcast collective. I think some of the coolest, most creative and funny podcasts out there, and I'm just not saying that. I really, really believe it. People like Chelsea Peretti and Dan Harmon and Matt Dwyer, Steve Agee and Todd Barry, just to name a few. Go to Feral Audio right now. Go to Feral Audio. I'm waiting. Go check that out. Also, I want to thank our sponsor, the Hotel Lincoln here in Chicago, but more importantly, I want to thank you for listening and all your support. We couldn't do it without you. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a
rich. I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I help people. She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My